Hi, I'm Terry Marr. Welcome to Traveling on Chris. For the next half hour, we'll feature travel tips and articles from a variety of publications. And I want to pick up where we left off last week with the Traveling Well edition of the New York Times via the Hartford Current. It's covering the adventures for 2024 by land, sea, and balloon. So we start with a town in the Ozarks with a song in its heart. The Folk Center in Mountain View, Arkansas, perpetuates the region's way of life and, most of all, its passion for music. This is by Richard Rubin. A merciful evening breeze kicked up, swatting away the Arkansas heat, giving wing to the melodies coming from two of the gazebos in the grassy park. In the larger one, a dozen people were playing the last strains of Barbary Allen on fiddles, mandolins, guitars, a stand-up bass, dulcimers, banjos, and even a dulcet banjo. Pretty tune I did not recognize drew me over to the smaller group, but I never got to ask what it was because as I approached, they stopped. Then their fiddler lowered his instrument and in a clear, bold bass started singing, "I've been everywhere, all of it." With the others playing along, he gave a performance Johnny Cash would have admired, no stumbles or stutters, not a single Bergville or ton forgotten. I did wonder, though, why he hadn't thrown in Mountain View, the town we were in that evening, not only because it would have fit so nicely with Barbaroo, Waterloo, Kalamazoo, but also because I suspected that he, like me and a lot of other people in that park, had gone to some effort to get there. Crafts and characters. All the roads to Mountain View, the seat of Stone County in the Ozarks of northern Arkansas, are two-lane and twist through towns with names like Pumpkin Bend, Grubbs, and Oil Trough. The last of these, a settlement beside the White River, traces its appellation back to the early 19th century, when hunters there used hollowed logs to render bear fat into lamp and cooking oil. Those roads are all paved now, though that wasn't the case until the 1970s. Mountain View wasn't electrified until the 1930s. Even decades later, it still lacked certain basic amenities, an absence that eventually played a part in the creation of the attraction that today brings many people to Mountain View for the first time, Ozark Folk Center State Park. Not exactly on the way to anywhere. You have to really want to come here, Keith Manowitz, the park's promotions director, said. Even so, some 90,000 people do every year. The center, which turned 50 last year, is singular among Arkansas's 52 state parks, in that its draw is not landscape and nature. Our resource here is the people, Mr. Manowitz explained. Our mission here is to perpetuate, present, and promote the Ozark way of life. They do so by giving the people of the region, which is rural and largely white, place to do the things they have always done, and where folks, quote, from off, unquote, as they say there, can watch them do it, and even try it themselves, making quilts, brooms, knives, and home remedies, carving wood, forging iron, weaving and dyeing fabric. One woman makes dolls from dried corn shucks, exactly as her mother did, and her grandmother before that. "Play with your garbage," she called out as I left her shop. No one is in costume or character, although some craftspeople come from off. Many, like that doll maker, are local residents who are just doing at the park what they would be doing at home. There was great isolation, really, for ever so long in the area, said Kay Thomas. Everyone learned to make, quote, stuff that you had to have for everyday existence, unquote. Ms. Thomas, who's retired now, came from off just out of high school and started working at the Folk Center when it opened. It's not uncommon to meet people who have been at the park that long or almost. A woman who worked at its gift shop until last spring grew up in a log cabin built by her father, no electricity or running water. That cabin, which the family abandoned in 1963, was later moved to the park and is now an exhibit there. We're not Branson. For people who hear Ozarks and think of the bright lights, capacious venues, and folky kitsch of Branson, Missouri, 110 or so miles northwest, this is very different. By design, there has always been a consciousness around the Folk Center. We're not Branson, Charlie Sandage, who helped get the center going, said. The Ozarks straddle the Arkansas-Missouri border, but the Missouri part is more industry, is more densely populated, and draws more visitors. Historically, Mr. Sandage said, Missourians thought they were better than Arkansas people. Like underdogs everywhere, people in the Arkansas Ozarks made that status a point of pride. They also had the confidence to go their own way. If just the Ozark region had voted before the Civil War, Mr. Sandage said, secession, quote, never would have happened, unquote. Back in the early 1960s, Mr. Sandage explained, Stone County was statistically among the poorest counties in the United States. The town needed a water and sewer system, but couldn't afford one. People started to wonder if Mountain View might be able to attract federal grants using, as Mr. Sandage put it, its deep pool of Ozark culture, which abided long after other such pools had dried up almost everywhere else. Folk Center was open within a decade. Today, in addition to local craftspeople and musicians, it features extensive gardens growing many heritage plants that Ozark people have made use of for generations, like jewelweed, whose juice can soothe chigger bites, and elderberry, which, when distilled into a tincture, is said to break fevers. And the park has a 1,000-seat theater which hosts shows, traveling acts, weekly square dances, and Ozark Highlands Radio, a variety program that airs on more than 100 stations nationwide. Time to make music. Mountain View got its water and sewer systems, but aside from that and the fact that you can get at least some cell phone service in town, it seems not much else has changed there since the 60s. Though Mountain View's economy depends to a large extent on tourism, the place is utterly authentic. People there are quite happy to have you there, but no one will fawn over you or do anything other than what they would be doing anyway. And what a great many of them are doing is making music together. Three nights a week, a modest space called the Mountain View Meeting Place becomes Club Possum, which hosts local musicians and bands, and live streams them on YouTube and Facebook. Shows last 2 hours, and admission is free. The audience is a mix of local and from off, and there's no bar. Stone County is dry, a fact many residents credit with preserving the town's character. Walk around town almost any evening when the weather is amenable, and you will see and hear musicians playing. Once I came upon four women, two banjos, two mountain dulcimers, jamming on the side porch of a shop called Mountain View Music. Folk Center is among the largest employers in the area, and many of the musicians you'll encounter in the evenings have day jobs at the park. One of the banjo players, who was a potter there, told me at her shop the next day that she also played with a different group on Saturdays. They play on porches, on lawns, at inns, and around the courthouse, but most often they play at a green space on Washington Street that people call the Pickin' Park. I've watched gatherings as small as 2 and as large as 15 jam together, individuals dropping in when they get off work or out when they go home to bed. They play bluegrass, folk music, country, and gospel. But the music you will hear most often is old-time string band. Tunes and ballads that traveled across the Atlantic on wooden ships in the 18th and 19th centuries. These are people whose ancestors settled in the Ozarks not long after the Louisiana Purchase, but also people from off who come with their instruments just to do this. Some have known each other for decades. Others have never met before. They have, it seems, a few unspoken rules. They don't use written music or electric speakers, and they never, ever pass the hat or open an instrument case, toss in a few seed dollars, and hope you'll follow their example. Some would offer a tip, they'd probably get their hand bit, Mr. Sandage, who plays guitar, said. Treasure for the ears. Other things that entice people from off to motor up these slender winding roads of Stone County include Blanchard Springs Caverns, subterranean wonderland on National Forest land that also celebrated its 50th anniversary. And it's tempting to conjure some metaphor about Mountain View being an underground treasure like those caves. But it's not. Its luster is right out in the open at the Folk Center and the Pickin' Park, on patches of grass all over town and on porches like the one at Mountain View Music. Scott Poole, the store's co-owner, summed up his town. Branson is a fun place to go. It's got a lot of attractions, a lot of theaters. But if you took away the tourists in Branson, there'd be nothing left. Here, if you took away all the tourists, it would hurt us all economically, but people would still be playing music on the square because it's for the love of the music. That's what they do. Taking off from school to take in the world. Off-season vacationing has long been considered a cost-saving boon, but should families with school-aged children take advantage? Is by Lauren Sloss. For her family vacation this year, Liz Thim booked a 10-day trip to Bocas del Toro, Panama, in February. Requested time off from her pharmacist job a year before that, and she shared itinerary ideas with her daughter and son, 11 and 9, to involve them in the planning process. One thing she did not do, schedule a trip around a school vacation. Much of Ms. Thim's approach to planning comes from the high costs and time constraints endured during a spring break vacation. The family, who lives in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, took to Puerto Rico in 2019. We paid $2,260 for 4 seats, had a 6-hour layover on the way there, and a 2:15 a.m. departure on the way home, she said. Those were the cheapest tickets. Taking a trip during the off-season traditionally offers travelers fewer crowds and reduced fares and has long been considered a boon for budget-conscious planners. This trend is all the more pressing as the appeal of a traditional summer vacation has diminished, particularly after last year's hot, expensive, and natural disaster-filled season. But can families with school-aged children take advantage? Some well-off parents, emboldened by the rise of remote work and schooling in the pandemic and fed up with the record-breaking high prices of peak season travel, are saying yes. People are feeling more freedom to be flexible, said Natalie Kurtzman, a travel advisor with Fora Travel in Boston, noting that many of her clients with families are increasingly comfortable extending school breaks to avoid high airfare prices that tend to appear during vacation periods. But teachers and school administrators worry about ramifications like students falling behind in schoolwork and the mixed messages that the practice might send. I feel like education is a privilege and some students see it as a burden, said Joanne Davi, a middle school teacher at St. Peter Martyr School in Pittsburgh, California. More travel year-round for all. Not all families in the United States are ditching school. Last year, in its U.S. Family Travel Survey, the Family Travel Association noted that summer and spring vacations remain the most popular times for families planning trips. 56% of respondents found the timing of school breaks to be a challenge, and 59% cited affordability as their most pressing issue. Since the pandemic, many Americans have been struggling to keep up with a rising cost of living. Persistent inflation has led to changes in spending behavior, including, for some, around travel. Affordability has always been the most challenging thing, said Lynn Minnert, professor at Edinburgh Napier University in Scotland and co-author of the 2023 Family Travel Association study. But now, prices are the highest I've ever seen them. Being able to travel off-season would make a big difference for many families. Anecdotally, at least, a desire for scheduling flexibility is taking root. Melissa Verboon started the Facebook group Travel with Kids in 2017 and writes a blog covering her family's travel. She said that the group's membership had grown since the pandemic, with more conversations centering on traveling during the school year. Ms. Verboon, who lives in Holiday, Florida and has four kids, 15, 13, 11, and 9, believes that family time at home during the pandemic was a major impetus for reimagining vacation scheduling. Stephanie Toe currently lives in Portland, Oregon, but in 2021 and 2022, traveled internationally with her husband and two daughters for more than a year. People had bought into the idea that their kids went to school at 8:15 and that you don't see them again until 4 in the afternoon. That was all shattered in 2020, she said. I wanted more time with my kids. Easier with younger children. For parents eager to travel with their offspring year-round, a pre-pandemic truth remains. It's significantly easier with younger grade school children who have fewer academic, extracurricular, and social demands. Ms. Thim, whose daughter started middle school this year, has discovered that school year travel planning is more challenging. I'm getting a little more nervous about taking her out, and she doesn't want to miss out on anything, she said. Allison McMaster, a travel advisor and corporate travel planner who lives outside Boston, has been traveling with her two sons, now 11 and 13, during the school year since they were young. The family has even spent close to a month in destinations like Peru, Colombia, and Europe. The education that they're going to receive by way of international travel and cultural experiences outweigh days missed in the classroom, she said. The best version of my kids is when we are traveling. She's unsure, however, if she'll be able to pull off an extended trip this year. As they've gotten older, it's become more important for them to be physically present in school, she said of the shift from elementary school. The upper schools hold students more accountable. There's a sort of unspoken pressure, she said. Ms. McMaster's sons attend a private school which has been accepting of their absences, extra work, and increased accountability aside. Public elementary and secondary school systems, which educate about 88% of U.S. school children, have varying levels of tolerance for missed days of school. In recent years, they have also been contending with a rash of absences, travel-related or not, and plunging test scores among their students. In Ms. Thim's Wisconsin School District, families may receive a letter from the school district requiring a meeting between the parents and school staff should a child miss more than 10 days of classes. We've never gotten a letter. My kids are both great students, and we usually only pull them out for 5 to 7 days, she said. But last year, my son had COVID, and he was out for 5 days because of that. I was definitely stressed about a trip we had planned, knowing that he couldn't get sick again and miss any more school. Ms. Davi's school in California, a student missed the first 3 weeks of classes this year for a trip. School's policy allows these absences, so long as the administration is informed beforehand, but teachers are not obligated to put together work packets. I tell the students we continue without you, so the responsibility is on you when you get back, Ms. Davi said, adding that classroom work and other assignments are online on Google Classroom. Whether or not a student will keep up is, quote, case by case, unquote. There are some students who are intrinsically motivated as it is, she said, but then there are students who are completely cut off. They come back and have no idea what's going on. Out of the classroom, out in the world. For some parents, the incompatibility of school schedules with travel desires leads families to drop out of school systems altogether, at least for a little bit. Word schooling, a loose term that refers to making travel a central part of a child's educational experience, can involve a month-long trip to Europe or years spent traveling. Parents might try to stick to the curriculum of a school back home using workbooks and remote learning tools, or choose to engage in more free-form, interest-driven learning. Ms. Tolk word schooled her daughters during their years on the road. The girls were 10 and 12 when they left, and while she and her husband initially tried to stick to a semi-strict schedule, daily math lessons, grammar exercises, and spelling lists, they quickly found themselves easing up, focusing instead on the places they were exploring. We ended up doing a lot of family projects. All four of us would research something we were interested in and present it to each other, she said. While they were in Egypt, one daughter did a project about ancient makeup traditions in Egypt, while another delved into the story of the wife of King Tutankhamun. Though there has long been a small community of families who travel with their children, Ms. Tolk believes that the pandemic and social media have both made world schooling a more approachable option. She is setting up three world schooling hubs through her company, Deliberate Detour, where families can meet up for learning and socializing in Peru, Guatemala, and Mexico. Meanwhile, her daughters, 12 and 14, are adjusting to attending public middle school in Portland, which has been challenging. The day feels long and overly structured. Jury's still out on how they'll fare academically, though so far they are finding the work easy, Ms. Tolk said. Still, the value of these trips remains incomparable. I've had a life of really impactful, powerful, transformative international experiences, Ms. Tolk said. I always knew that I wanted that for my children. Type all day, toast all night, the rise of remote work wedding. Nuptials are stretching out well into the work week, by Julie Weed. A growing number of wedding guests are bringing a new kind of plus one to the festivities, their remote jobs. When Anna Sullivan, a 25-year-old who works in digital marketing, and Taylor Brandenberger, a 26-year-old home inspector, got married last October in East Lansing, Michigan, 10 of the bride's friends started the wedding weekend a few days early. They rented an Airbnb where they could work remotely during the day and then got together for dinner and hangouts in the evening, all without taking any time off. Many of the guests even stayed through Monday, flying home in the evening after they had logged off. The wedding day goes by in a blur, the bride, who has since changed her last name to Brandenberger, said. Having the extra time with people is so valuable. Since the height of the pandemic, remote work has dramatically changed both offices and those who work in them. After initially being forced to work from home, many employees now enjoy all remote or hybrid schedules. According to the Pew Research Center, one-third of American workers currently have some freedom to work remotely, even if it is just 1 or 2 days a week. Wedding guests who have hybrid schedules are increasingly using them to spend a few more days wherever the celebration takes them, and hotels, wedding planners, and couples are taking note and making changes. Attendance may even hinge on the possibility of remote work. Brandenburgers plan their ceremony and reception on a Friday night to save money on renting the space. That meant some guests from out of town who had to be physically at work that day and couldn't take time off weren't able to attend, Ms. Brandenberger said. Some couples choose to make a weekend destination out of their ceremony. Such weddings have long been a boon to hotels and resorts, many of which also added workspaces and upgraded their Wi-Fi to cater to remote workers during the pandemic. Now the two trends are converging. Camptown, a 50-room hotel that opened last year in Leeds, New York, at the foot of the Catskill Mountains, wedding-related stays have been getting longer, said Stephen Wendell, chief executive of Mountain Shore Properties, which owns the hotel. When guests realize they can work from the lodge, which offers high-speed internet and workspaces, he said, they start thinking about relaxing and getting into wedding mode and extending their bookings. Currently, about 20% of wedding guests arrive at Camptown from Tuesday to Thursday for a weekend ceremony, Mr. Wendell said. You see people at the pool with laptops taking calls on nature paths. All right, 36 hours. Itineraries for a weekend outing or a stop along the way. Durham, North Carolina. The evolution of Durham from a faded tobacco town to a diverse cultural and culinary destination has been years in the making, but the ongoing development of this central North Carolina city seems to have reached a new stage. The resurgent downtown area along a transitional neighborhood is now brimming with new restaurants, boutiques, bars, and breweries. While construction continues amid the historic brick warehouses, tobacco factories, and textile mills, visitors today have reason to venture farther to emerging hotspots in East Durham and the old Five Points neighborhood. Traffic, food, drink, and local color are all there to discover across Durham, residents call the dynamic Bull City. Friday, 3:30 p.m., visit a campus museum. If you happen to be in town this week, stop by Duke University's Nasher Museum of Art for Act As If You Are a Curator, organized not by the staff, but by OpenAI's ChatGPT. The eclectic AI-generated exhibition spans Mesoamerican stone figures and Salvador Dali works selected from the museum's nearly 14,000-piece collection, though many were mislabeled by the chatbot, as noted by a Flesh and Blood curator. While on campus, stroll through the Sarah P. Duke Gardens, where 5 miles of serene pathways wind past magnolias, blooming roses, and a lake reflecting autumnal colors. 6 p.m. feast on Carolina seafood. Fresh seasonal seafood caught off the North Carolina coast is a simple winning formula at Saltbox Seafood Joint, a restaurant owned by the chef Ricky Moore, who earned the 2022 James Beard Award for the best chef in the Southeast. What began as a tiny takeaway shack in the old Five Points neighborhood is now a spacious, but still frill-free, sit-down locale on Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard. Luckily, the menu hasn't changed much. You can still get heaping plates of fried oysters, blue crab, mullet and clams with generous portions of fried potatoes and collard greens. My go-to is the fried catfish sandwich topped with red cabbage slaw and a side of hush honeys, cornmeal fritters drizzled with honey. 8:30 p.m. Try a local beer by the fire pit. Competition is growing among the many craft breweries downtown. We're out of town brewers, like Asheville's Solver and Highwire Brewing, have opened Durham tap rooms in an area that's already home to longtime local favorites like Full Steam Brewery and the Dirty Bowl Brewing Company. But the most atmospheric place for a locally brewed pint is easily Ponysaurus Brewing Company, an independent craft brewery with a garden strung with lights. Try the Tangerine Tinge Golden Rule Sison and a scoop of the house snack mixes like the Pretzel and Peanutty Bartender's Blend. Saturday, 9:30 a.m., take a history lesson. Swing by Monet's, a 9th Street bakery and cafe, to pick up a cinnamon and molasses glazed pumpkin spice donut and hot apple cider, steaming blend of apple cider and chai tea, before heading out west for a dive into North Carolina history. Beyond Civil War scholars, few are likely to recall what transpired at Bennett Place, a historic farmstead about 6 miles northwest of downtown. One of the few Civil War sites not associated with battle, this out-of-the-way landmark is where the Union General William T. Sherman and the Confederate General Joseph E. Johnston negotiated the largest troop surrender of the war, nearly 90,000 soldiers from the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida, inside the home of a local family in 1865. Begin a visit in the small museum where a short video explains the site's significance, then head across the lawn to tour the reconstructed farmhouse and surrounding outbuildings. 12 p.m., seek sandwiches in the East. Former food desert, East Durham has emerged as a lunchtime destination for hungry diners from across the city. You'll know you found Ideals, a sandwich shop that opened in 2021 by the line snaking down the sidewalk. Don't worry, it moves quickly. Here, freshly baked rolls, sesame-crusted hoagies, and rosemary focaccia are the foundation for superb deli sandwiches. Best is the Philly-style roast pork with provolone and garlicky broccoli rabe, and the thick-cut garlic and onion potato chips. Another notable newcomer is Mike D's Barbecue. Go there for a brisket sandwich doused with the signature smoky sweet sauce, a side of smoked beans, and sweet tea. 2 p.m., sip North Carolina bourbon. Whatever your preferred spirit, there is likely someone in Durham distilling it. Small production craft booze from mead and cider to gin and rye have exploded in popularity, and one producer worth seeking out is Mystic Farm and Distillery, 6 miles east of downtown. Drop in at this bucolic 22-acre bourbon distillery for a free tasting of the full range of spirits, including the award-winning Broken Oak Bourbon and a smooth cacao-finished version made with cacao nibs from Raleigh's Vitery Chocolate Factory. Small group tours are also offered on weekends. Reserve in advance. 4 p.m., flip through records and secondhand finds. Supporting local businesses is a point of pride in this fiercely loyal city, as evidenced by the growing number of small independent shops downtown. Start on West Parish Street in the Durham Vintage Collective, an inviting secondhand boutique that opened in July where you might find plaid miniskirts, leather jackets, or a framed Jean-Michel Basquiat lithograph. Across the street, explore Chet Miller, a gift shop with Durham-themed throw pillows, small press travel guides, cookbooks from local chefs, and game night jigsaw puzzles. Next door, Utopia Design sells exquisite Polish glassware and handcrafted ceramics. Scope out the latest color splash exhibition at LOS Gallery, sunny space that opened in August showcasing contemporary art from Black, female, and other diverse and underrepresented artists. Then continued to East Main Street to browse vinyl albums of jazz, soul, rock, and bluegrass at Carolina Soul Records and at the new location of Bull City Records across the street. 7 p.m., dine on fresh Mexican-American flavors. Downtown Durham is packed with great restaurants, but head a bit north to the old Five Points neighborhood, where the city's latest hotspot, Little Bull, opened in June. The chef Oscar Diaz, already well-known in Raleigh for his Mexican-American cuisine, again tapped his heritage when creating the playful menu. Highlights of a recent meal included crudo with North Carolina tuna, aguachile, wasabi, and flying fish roe, plantain empanadas, and soft dumplings stuffed with goat birria in a bowl of rich consomme. Stick to the small plates as portions are generous and save room for dessert. Churro balls with chocolate sauce are divine. 9 p.m. Sip martinis in the former coffin shop. At the end of 2022, the city designated most of downtown social district called the Bullpen, where folks are permitted to walk around with alcoholic beverages purchased in the area. So if the bar is packed at the Velvet Hippo, a lively rooftop lounge that opened in August serving fruity slushes and creative cocktails, you can take that frozen Hawaiian rum punch to go and stroll over to Motorco Music Hall, a concert venue that also hosts dance parties, like a recent Taylor Fest for local Swifties, or continue to Corpse Reviver, a cocktail bar associated with the Durham Distillery, which opened in 2020 in a former coffin shop and serves dirty martinis garnished with bacon and blue cheese stuffed olives. Sunday, hike along the river, 9 a.m. Catch the season at its most colorful along the Eno River, where there are dozens of trails to choose from in the Eno River State Park and in West Point on the Eno, state park 5 miles north of downtown that is anchored by the historic West Point Mill. One scenic route begins at the mill, then climbs through the forest along the river, follow the yellow trail markers. After about 20 minutes, hop across the rocks, crossing a shallow tributary to reach Sennett's Hole, a natural pool and popular summertime swimming spot, with small waterfalls and turtles warming themselves on the rocks on sunny days. 11 a.m., slurp some noodles, refuel after a hike with brunch at Rose's Noodles, Dumplings and Sweets, a former meat market and sweet shop near Brightleaf Square that evolved into a casual East Asian-inspired eatery serving fragrant bowls of beef pho and Thai rice soup. The selection of cakes, cookies, and pastries is impressive, but best are the ice cream sandwiches that easily serve, too. My favorite is the white miso flavor between chewy ginger snaps. All right, that's all the traveling time we have today. I'm Terry Marr, so long until next time.